This episode is sponsored by Bubs Naturals, yet another company that I tracked down to bring on as a sponsor because I myself love their products. They are offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, a 20% discount. But before we get to that, I do want to highlight a few of the products that I use myself. Firstly, collagen. I am about to turn 50, and so my hair, my skin, my nails, not really a big concern when I was younger, definitely a lot more of a concern now. However, where I've really seen the impact is joint health and gut health, and I've been blown away that when I'm consistent using collagen, Bubs collagen in this case, I see a massive improvement in both. Another area, I drink coffee, love coffee, and in the morning I use the Halo Creamer. Now, originally I used the MCT oil powder, but now they have the Halo Creamer, which has also got grass-fed butter in it, a lot more creamy if you're not trying to go for the vegan option that they have as well. Now, it's important to mention as well the altruistic element of Bubs Naturals. The origin story involves Glenn Bub Doherty, one of the two Navy SEALs killed in Benghazi, and a good friend of the founders, Sean and TJ. So 10% of every single sale goes towards the Glenn Doherty Foundation. Now, as I mentioned before, they are offering you, the audience, 20% off your purchase if you use the code SHIELD. That's S-H-I-E-L-D at bubsnaturals.com. And finally, if you want to hear more about their products and Glenn's powerful story, listen to episode 558 with co-founder Sean Lake. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome back onto the show the head of the Nuffield Laboratory of Ophthalmology and the Sleep and Circadian Neuroscience Institute at the University of Oxford, Professor Russell Foster. Now, if you haven't heard my first conversation with Russell, it is episode 647, and I highly recommend that you listen to that. In the second conversation, we discuss a multitude of topics, from the impact of the pandemic on society, gut biome, light, moral courage, some optimistic science when it comes to addressing strokes, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I welcome back onto the show Professor Russell Foster. Enjoy. Well, Russell, I want to start by saying thank you so, so much for coming back onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Oh, well, thank you, James. It's a great honor and a privilege, of course.
Well, our initial conversation was about 3 years ago, and we discussed a host of topics. I'm sure there'll be
long.
It is.
I can't believe it was that long. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, I believe so. August 2022, if I'm not mistaken. I'm sure there'll be a little overlap, but some of these topics are just going to be worth revisiting. But I think if we're talking about mid-2022, the first kind of icebreaker would be what you have seen in this world of sleep medicine and this world of neuroscience as far as the impact of the pandemic for the last few years. Because obviously at the time, decisions were made, people were isolated, we all know that story. But what isn't being told is what was the ripple effect of that and what can we learn from maybe doing it a little differently next time?
Yeah, I think that the fact that people had to stay inside was a very significant impact upon sleep and circadian health. In that we live, as you know, in dim dark caves. And what I would urge your listeners to do is to load onto their smartphone a lux meter. And there's lots of different apps that are available, free. And you can then get a sense of how much light we experience inside. Go up to the window and you see, you know, 3,000, 4,000, and of course where you are, much more than that, and go outside, you'll be getting 100,000 lux. And yet inside, we'll be lucky to get maybe 300, 400, 500 lux. And the clock needs a very robust exposure to the light-dark cycle to regulate it. And we were inside, so we were being cut off from that essential signal to stabilize the circadian clock and the sleep-wake cycle. And so I think people's sleep patterns began to drift. And that's not ideal. And there was internal desynchrony. So different bits of the body were doing different things. It wasn't all beautifully coordinated. I think last time I used the analogy of an orchestra, you know, all the different body parts, like the members of an orchestra, playing at the same time in this wonderful symphony. Without that sort of robust regulation by the light-dark cycle, everything starts to play at a slightly different time. And instead of a symphony, you have a cacophony. So that was one thing. But I think a very interesting other observation was the change in people's patterns of sleep. So what we know is that if we have the opportunity to sleep longer, sleep can go into a biphasic or polyphasic mode, which means you go to sleep, you wake up, you go back to sleep again, and you can do this several times throughout the night. And this occurs, you know, even in young people. So experiments were done in the States, where individuals were placed under 12 hours of dark, 12 hours of light, and their sleep pattern became biphasic, polyphasic, and these are in young males. And so what happened during the pandemic is that people didn't have to commute. So they gained, in many cases, you know, they saved 2 hours or 4 hours on their daily commute, and they didn't have to get up as early, and so they slept longer. And so despite this, though, what was so fascinating is people reported having worse sleep, even though they had the opportunity to sleep longer. And what was going on, of course, is that people didn't know about this biphasic, polyphasic pattern. They'd wake up and they think, oh, my God, you know, all the horrors of what was going on, you know, worry about family, friends and the bigger picture would make it more difficult to go back to sleep. And they thought, you know, anyway, well, I might as well, you know, stop struggling, start having drinking coffee and doing emails. And so even though there was greater opportunity to sleep, the reports were people got worse sleep. That's because they were unaware of this. It's perfectly normal to wake up. If you stay calm, stay relaxed, keep the lights relatively low, you will go back to sleep. And so those are the two observations from my side. And I think the other thing, while we're talking about light, is that unless you get outside, you're not getting sufficient UVB exposure to make vitamin D. And there are some suggestions that people became vitamin D deprived over that period, which of course has a knock-on effect. We know, of course, the role of vitamin D in bone mineralization and all the rest of it, but it has a big impact upon our immune responses, and there's some evidence on mental health and sleep as well. So taking vitamin D3 supplement when we have the next horror, I think, was going to be really quite important. The government recommendation should be take vitamin D3 supplementation if you're not getting outside. And to my knowledge, there was no real discussion of that. And that could have a big impact upon health, including our sleep and mental health.
What was interesting, let me rephrase that. What was actually quite disappointing was seeing the any topic would turn into like Flanders fields. You'd have two, you know, trenches of extremism and no real kind of common sense in the middle in a lot of these areas. What is the connection between stress, lack of sleep, and the simple ability to critically think?
Oh, it's profound. Most people don't have a sleep problem. They have an anxiety or a stress issue. And that makes it either difficult to get off to sleep, and if you wake up, getting back to sleep. And that disrupted sleep can have a really profound effect upon your ability to process information and indeed your emotional responses. You become more irritable, more impulsive, less empathetic, which I think is absolutely fascinating. You fail to pick up the social signals from other people, whether it's work colleagues or family or friends. Another fascinating area is that the tired brain remembers negative experiences and forgets the positive ones. So one's entire worldview is biased towards the negative, and that's the sort of the basis for decision making. And so the more anxious you get, the greater the levels of stress, the worse the sleep becomes and more disrupted. And then your ability to process emotional and cognitive information really does begin to fall apart. Lots of people who have contacted me since the pandemic said they were in such a black place in terms of their mood and their relationships with others. It was, a profoundly difficult time. And at all levels, I mean, in the UK, you know, kids were doing classes online. And so they were isolated from their entire peer group. And then we throw them, you know, into university after the pandemic or college. And they had to learn the skills that they would have acquired, you know, sort of by osmosis, by just interacting with others. So I think it was a really quite damaging time.
I've made this comment quite a few times recently. It really saddens me, having grown up in myself, kind of, I was young in the 80s, and having Blue Peter and John Craven's News Round and all these, you know, programs for young people that were really teaching us about the world, pulling us together, the fundraise, you know, for the famine in Ethiopia. There was Live Aid, there was Comic Relief. And then you circle around again, kind of this era now, whether it's COVID, whether it's Gaza, whatever it is, where there's clearly something that we all need to stand up and talk about. And there isn't that compassion. And I honestly believe that this overstress, undersleep element of modern society, and especially the division that we've seen the last few years, has really hacked at the compassion that I would argue is at the heart of, you know, normal American people, normal British people. Yeah. But, you know, you're seeing that really dulled by, you know, I'm assuming these environmental elements.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. Having, you know, worked in the States for 8 years, and the rest of my life has been in the UK, I agree. I think there is a kindness and there is a generosity of spirit and a willingness to help that has become massively eroded. And I'm not quite sure why. I mean, you can see this it just in the way that people drive, and people won't be let in. And my daughter had an incident just recently where somebody, she was indicating to get into the next lane, and this person just wouldn't let her. And she, you know, she pulled over and she called us. She was crying. She said, "Why did he do that? There was no need to behave like that." And I think this is what many of us are seeing a lot of, and it really, really distresses me. For myself, I listened to the morning news on the radio since undergraduate days, and I suppose 2021, 2020, I just stopped listening to the morning news. I wake up now to, in the UK, Radio 3, which is the classical channel, and we used to religiously watch the news on the television. We don't simply do it at all now. And so I do get some news feeds on my smartphone. But, you know, it's such an unmitigated drip, drip, drip of ghastliness that it can really send you into a state where you don't want to be. And I don't think it's very difficult. The media have to do what the media do, but we only get the negative. We don't hear about the success stories and the great scientific breakthroughs, or the breakthroughs in the social sciences, or, you know, new discoveries and excitement. And I don't understand why we haven't reoriented our news channels to a lot more of those discussions of human success rather than, I mean, clearly we have to be aware of all the nasty stuff that's going on. But in equal measure, we have to realize that we are a species capable of such kindness and such humanity and such decency. that we've got to emphasize that again, that we haven't lost it. It's there, but we've got to try and get it back up to the surface.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I post a lot of those kind videos online. There was one actually, it was a children's BBC one, and they had all these children, you know, and some were different races, some had special needs, but these kids were just talking about, well, yeah, she runs faster than me, and he likes Conkers and I don't like Conkers, and they're not seeing the exterior shell. Of course they see it, they're aware of it, but that's not the person that they see. And I feel like that kind of innocence that is inbred in us in children because of these environmental pressures are kind of chipped away. And but I do believe that we're at the beginning of an awakening. I feel like the cracks are starting to show, and there's an urging now, you know, a need to go back to exactly what we're talking about when we were younger.
Yeah. I mean, it's again, for me, it's just simple kindness and generosity of spirit. You know, I mean, the person who lives over the road, they sort of say, shall I take your bins in? I say, oh, thanks so much. I'm a bit stiff today. You know, it's that kind of connectedness that we don't have as much as we did, I think, in the past.
Absolutely. Well, mentioning, you know, social media and some of the things that are adding to this disconnection, before we hit record, you talked about the study that you're doing with the government now on artificial light, and then some of the myths around devices. So, you know, what is the study that you're working on? And then let's debunk some of the misinformation that's being put out there.
Yeah, so the title, it's part of a government reporting body. It's an independent, but it is funded by the government, called COMERI, which is the Committee on the Medical Aspects of Radiation in the Environment. And I was brought into the committee to deal with a visual bit. You know, there's lots on sort of radiation, and there's lots on low frequency, you know, radio waves and stuff. But there was, ironically, nobody in that vision bit. And because I'd worked as the science advisor for a House of Lords report on the impact of light and noise pollution on human health, there were recommendations that came from that. So they asked me to join the committee, and then let's get a clear understanding of what we know and what we need to know about the impact of light on human health, artificial light on human health. So I brought a group together, we meet fairly shortly, of experts, and we're going to take different bits of the subject and come up with this report. And let me give you an example. And I have to say that some of my colleagues in the business of science haven't been necessarily as helpful as they could have been. You know, there were reports out there saying you shouldn't see more than 30 lux of light for 2 hours before you go to bed. Now, that's really dim light. And if you're an elderly individual with somewhat reduced sight, let's say, then wandering around for 2 hours under 30 lux increases the chance of falls and accidents and all of that sort of stuff. And that's just silly. And it's based upon data. Let me give you one example. And we hear a lot in the media about you shouldn't look at your light emitting tablet, your Kindle, before you go to bed. And it's based upon a study that got people to look at a Kindle on its brightest light intensity for 4 hours immediately before bedtime on five consecutive nights. At the end of that, yes, there were some effects upon melatonin, but melatonin is a hormone that modulates sleep. If you actually looked at sleep-wake timing was delayed by 9 minutes, just statistically significantly. And one of my colleagues from the States said, well, that may be statistically significant, but biologically, that's meaningless. And yet, you know, the headlines from all over the world is, if you look at a Kindle before you go to bed, you're going to harm your health and your sleep. Now, one key point about that experiment is that prior to that 4 hours of light exposure in the evening, people were maintained under dim light, 90 lux, during the day. And what the Scandinavian group then did was give people 500 to 600 lux for 6 hours during the middle of the day. That abolished all effects of melatonin and sleep-wake timing. No detectable effect of looking at Kindle before you go to bed. And this is the problem. We've got lab-based studies, which are then being extrapolated to the real world. And it's just not good enough. And if people are getting out and getting a moderate amount of light during the day, they're going to not sensitize their clock in the evening. So it's those sorts of things. So what we've got to do is try and integrate how much light for how long, what its color, its wavelength should be, what your light history is. Have you spent time outside or are you inside all the time? How old you are. It's clear that young people are more, that their circadian system is more sensitive to light than in elderly people. We've got to take into account seasons. And I think rather than, you know, you stick a bunch of scientists into a room and you ask them to come up with recommendations. Sure, they're going to come up with the recommendations on the basis of the data we've got. And my argument is we don't have all the data yet. And it's a very biased set of data because it's using assays which may not be real world, and they're all lab based. So that's what I'm trying to do. And as I say, we're starting our studies shortly to get that paper together, and hopefully it will define the experiments that we need to do in the real world. And they're not that difficult. I mean, it's easy now to measure people's rest activity cycles, how alert they are, what light exposure they get in a whole different set of settings. And we can use that field data, I think, then to genuinely inform evidence-based guidelines for how we should expose ourselves to artificial light. And it is really important. The architects are crying out for this sort of information. It's fascinating. I've been talking to architects over the past few years, and they sort of fall into two groups. One group say, oh, God, light, natural light. Oh, I just ignore it. You just build a space and you just stick electric lights in it, and that's it. It's a nuisance. And in fact, it's quite interesting. There are some proposals for building new builds in London where they limit the size of the windows hugely because of the fear of overheating. And with increased warmth in the environment, you know, they don't want to use air conditioning in the UK, so they're going to make tiny, tiny windows. Just madness. And the other group of architects are, you should only use artificial light when you can't use natural light. And so they embrace natural light. I was at a meeting early in the year by the Daylight Academy, and it was wonderful. They made me a fellow, and it's absolutely fascinating listening to what the architects are interested in and what they want. And I think we've let them down. We haven't given them the evidence-based guidelines that we absolutely need.
Well, I can just say as a consumer or as an employee, when you're in a place that has a lot of natural light, again, as long as it's not, you know, overwhelming, then yeah. It just, you know, it's a more pleasant place to be. And what blows me away in America here, in Florida specifically, is you'll have one of these big stores, Target, Walmart, and they'll have no skylights and then artificial light, which must cost, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars as well. But it also, you walk in and you just don't want to be in there because it is this kind of, you know, non-natural environment. Whereas you see some of these people that have spent a little bit more money on whatever it is, the way that they've designed their stores. And maybe there are, like you said, a combination of skylights and some lights, because obviously in the evening you're going to need the light. And you just, you want to stay there, whether it's as an employee or whether it's someone who's just shopping in a shop.
Absolutely right, and there's some. I'm working on a new book about light and its impact on health, and there's some sections on psychology of light and lighting, and the thing that's so fascinating, you know, again talking to the architects, we can just sort of bung in LED lights, which are cheap, they don't use lots of energy, so it's great. But of course, where we used to use one incandescent bulb, because LEDs are so cheap, there's a huge amount of LED lighting, which of course multiplies the cost of the electrical usage. So whilst they individually are quite cheap to run, because we use them at high density, you know, we're not saving that much money any longer, which goes back to your point. Why the hell aren't we letting light in, natural light into our built spaces? And as I say, it's sort of a group of architects. They say, no. I can't deal with it. You know, let's just get rid of it. Fascinating, actually. Completely different mindset to, I think, those of us who like to live in buildings.
Yeah. Well, we even have things called solar tubes in my house. There's two of them, one in my son's bathroom, one in the laundry room. And I keep, you know, you'll think, oh God, I left the light on. And you realize you didn't. Just that yeah. one little tube that's probably 8 inches, you know, diameter. And it just illuminates the whole room. It's incredible. So yeah. you know, just those two rooms, what are you saving just on that?
Well, but on the other side, which is also quite interesting, because of the ubiquitous use of light, of course, artificial light at night, Alan, on the animal world is a big problem. I mean, insect life, bird life. But up until recently, the work on humans wasn't so well developed, because what people do is they'd use satellite imagery to calculate the sort of a predicted light exposure of individuals of light at night, and then they correlate it with incidence of coronary heart disease. And my criticism of those studies was, well, you've got to get individual light exposure. You can't just have a satellite image which has which covers about a mile in area. And just recently, a paper has been published where they've measured individual light exposure and a whole risk of health conditions of keeping the lights on at night. And actually, in thousands of individuals, and it's quite convincing, there are impacts upon coronary heart disease and emotions and sleep. And so I think, we're beginning to get the data that it's not just the animal world and indeed the plant world. I mean, when plants start to flower, for example, with artificial light at night, but also on humans. So not connecting with the light dark cycle, the natural light dark cycle, and just flicking a switch. We've got to, again, tune into that, I think, a lot more than we have done. And of course, that was going back to where we started. One of the great problems with COVID, we're inside and we were almost exclusively exposed to light at night.
Since we spoke, I came across a study, and I had the gentleman on the show who, and he did a study on, and we've talked about this in the previous conversation, most firefighters in America work 56 hours a week. And the usual one is what's called 24-48, 24 hours, you know, at the station, so disrupted or no sleep, and then a 48-hour period off. And there's been a push to because things aren't working, the recruitment crisis is getting worse and worse, and, you know, the health crisis and the mental health crisis. And one of the solutions was let's do 48 hours in a row and then have a 96-hour period. Which to anyone who understands anything about physiology, immediately you just go, well, that's insane. The problem was, this gentleman did a study, and I'm defending him. He was a volunteer firefighter, never worked in the career field, you know, and just went in it with a good heart. But and he did the study, and they went, oh, actually, the 48 hours in a row, you know, is healthier than the 24. And so what ended up happening when we had our conversation is the department that he studied ran one call a shift and usually slept all night every shift. Now, you have all these urban and suburban fire departments that took that study and were like, well, it's healthier, who are running 20 calls a shift and, you know, are up all night. And what I realized very recently, because they keep doing this, they keep studying this 56 rather than, well, the Northeast of America works 42 hours a week. Why don't we study those two and put them side by side? And so we have a lack of cultural competency in the research of our profession, which I'm seeing is becoming very dangerous, because someone, you know, a little dot knowledge is a dangerous thing. They grab one study, just like you alluded to, and they run with it and arguably make an already broken system even worse. So what is your kind of perspective on science? Everyone screams for data. Where is that line, A, between, you know, common sense where a study isn't even needed, and B, where the wrong science can be latched onto and making things even worse?
Yeah, I think it is complicated. And we do need, I think the thing that we haven't done is longitudinal studies. So it's all been very short term. And as you say, very selected groups. So it is complicated, and what we need to do, and we can do, as I was alluding to earlier, you know, we can measure rest activity cycles. We can get a reaction time easily from somebody's, you know, from a thing on a smartphone. We can look at the impact of blood glucose really easily. We can look at stress hormones. And so rather than sort of biting off bits and chunks of this sort of question, we need some long-term deep dive studies on large numbers of individuals in different sectors. And you were saying, you know, comparing the sort of rural fire person population versus inner city Chicago or whatever. And with that, make some evidence-based conclusions. I think we're all, you know, it's like the lighting industry, it's like architects, all thrashing around for some data, and we'll latch on to data that can, as you rightly point out, James, can be profoundly misleading. And so what I'm trying to do with the impact of artificial light on human health is get some consensus and identify what we need to know to get those evidence-based guidelines, rather than just jumping in with the best will, as this individual clearly was trying to do a good job, but it can be taken out of context. So yes, some scientific rigor, and engagement with the scientific community, I think, is really important. But the problem is that these studies are not cheap. And I'm bombarded by people saying, oh, you know, why don't we do this? And can I be? And I'd say I'd love to. But do you know, it's really expensive, because to do it properly, I'm going to have to employ a postdoctoral scientist or a PhD student on of this for 3 or 4 years to make it coherent. And that's really expensive. And I think, you know, they can say, can you just tack it on? Can you just add it on to what you're already doing? And you can't. You've got to take it seriously, and you've got to regard it as a freestanding, you know, a set of experiments. And so, yeah, it's sadly throwing money at to get it done properly.
Well, the one takeaway that he found, and I'll credit him absolutely for this, because it really opened the door for this conversation, is bearing in mind that they didn't get woken up that night, you know, still somewhat disrupted, because the potential of getting woken up, I think, still keeps you from a deep sleep. Yes. But that you alluded to earlier, the commute. So we normally start 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. And a lot of us can't afford to live anywhere near if we work in a city. So my commute was like a 75-minute commute. So I'm getting up at 5 in the morning to go to the station. Well, if you've got this 48-hour period, day two, you're in the station. If you didn't get any calls that night, now you've technically had a longer sleep, because you didn't get up at 5 to go to work. So the 48-hour thing still is a horrible idea. But to take that away, we work 24-hour shifts. That's a dial that we can spin in any way, shape, or form. So now the conversation has also been, well, then why don't we start at 11 a.m., 12 noon? So now you wake up, you have breakfast with your family, you wake up at a normal time, then you take the kids to school, then you drive to the fire station. And if you were at the station, you know, and you just got beat up all night, you're running calls, now you can sleep in an extra hour or two and then get out at 10 o'clock, you know, get your rig ready, you know, have coffee with everyone, and then head home. So I know there's been conversations in the schools, but talk to me about it. The way we've always done it is everyone starts work at 8 or goes to school at 8. What is the conversation now about extending that wake up time and the physical and mental health of whatever population that's affecting?
Yeah, well, there's some rumbles of a discussion. So I work with colleagues in Western Australia, up in the northwest, in the mining district of the Pilbara. So they're flying in, fly in, fly out group. You know, they're flying from Perth to the Pilbara, but their shift starts, you know, let's say at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock or whatever. But as you say, they've had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get the bus or the car, to get the plane that then flies them up. And so people aren't thinking about that part of the commute, which is, I think, really important. The medics I work with, they're still of us, they're getting better, but it's still, well, you know, it's part of the rites of passage, you know, you just got to work through it. And you know, it, again, that whole area of sleep is for wimps, it still lingers like a rather nasty smell out there. We haven't got rid of it completely, even in the medical professions, although they're becoming more aware of it as the new generation are coming through. So I think there is increased awareness, but it's not really taken on. The sector that I think is moving the fastest which I think is fascinating, is the business sector. I spend quite a bit of time talking to various businesses, you know, about prioritizing sleep, about the opportunities that good sleep can provide a business, and what bad sleep will, how bad sleep will harm a business. You know, I often wonder, and I've got no data for it, but, you know, if we think about the last financial crash, it was a whole bunch of jocks who were utterly sleep deprived, you know, and therefore making, I suspect, making incredibly poor decisions and impulsive decisions because they were chronically sleep deprived, which ultimately cost the world economy trillions because a bunch of tired jocks were pushing the wrong buttons. And I think the business sector have sort of got that. And are beginning to understand how you should structure a working day, making it more flexible, and taking into account chronotype, you know, whether you're a morning type or an evening type. And something I've long argued is that if you have an international business, you should voluntarily chronotype your workforce. So those in, you know, Europe, let's say it's a European based industry, then the morning types, you know, look after the Asian markets, then the intermediate types, and then the late types are doing the North American markets. And so essentially you're accommodating, and you've got a team which is to some extent optimized to the particular time zone, and or certainly be sensitive to the fact that people will be working outside of their biological time, which would allow them to make the most efficient and sensible decisions. And so, you know, what we argue for surgeons and surgery was there was a point saying, yeah, let's have surgeries running 24 hours a day. Then we can use the operating theaters, you know, fully. We can get through the waiting lists and all the rest of it. And then I said, well, yeah, but you're going to need two people to do this because one's got to check what the other is doing and not making mistakes. And therefore, you're not going to have a saving of costs because surgeons are very expensive, as are all the nursing staff and all the support that you need to do that. And so, you know, it's still a pretty simplistic view of our biology by our rulers. They don't get it yet, but it is shuffling forward. And as I say, you know, I find it fascinating that most of the talks I'm asked to give outside of academia are to the business sector. In fact, it was great. I got a trip to Istanbul very recently, but as a result, talking to some very, you know, serious, the financially powerful individuals. And we had a brilliant time. I mean, they're open to it and open to the discussion. And we spent, you know, a big chunk of a day and a half, you know, discussing the impact and the importance of this. So they're open to it and they want to look at ways in which they can improve performance. In the same way that another sector, which I'm not directly speaking to, but in sports and high performance athletics, they really are embracing sleep and timing and all of those sorts of things. To get that subtle edge is the difference between a gold medal and a fourth place position.
Well, and that's what's so crazy. Then you flip that round to police, fire, EMS. I mean, you're talking about split second decisions that, you know, a life is at stake, you know. So this is why we have it kind of backwards. You know, I think the sporting community is using it, we certainly need to be using it in all the areas where people could die.
Could not agree more, which is why I'm so happy to chat to you, James, because our front line, you know, are the group that we need to look after in that regard. I mean, you were talking about, you know, the commute home. So there's a study, which I think I may have mentioned last time, in junior doctors, you know, 57% had reported either having a crash or a near miss on the drive home in the early hours of the morning after the night shift, you know, and so why on earth were they not being given an app for their smartphone that they could detect whether they were nodding or the car was moving laterally? And of course, high-end cars have all this technology built into it, but junior doctors don't usually have that kind of income. And the same for nurses, and the same for the other first line individuals. And so it's we've got to do a better job. I mean, the other thing, which I can't remember if we talked about or not, but, you know, vaccination. the impact of a vaccination has a big effect depending upon how tired you are. And presumably because how high the stress hormones are hitting. So if you haven't slept before a vaccination, then the efficacy of that vaccination drops really very significantly. And also the same if you haven't slept significantly after a vaccination as well. So we should be prioritizing that when our frontline staff get vaccination, they should make sure they're rested in that period before the vaccination. Otherwise, the vaccination will drop in its efficiency, and they're the ones that are most vulnerable. It's that sort of kind of stuff we can do. We know enough to institute that.
It's interesting you say that, because during COVID, my whole platform was just standing in the middle, because there was one truth in all of that. If you were all in on the vaccines and you thought that was a be-all and end-all and masks, then the healthier you are, just as you alluded to, the healthier and more wet rested you are, the higher the efficacy of the vaccine. If you are completely opposed to the vaccine and the time developing all that stuff was worrying you, then again, the health of the individual determines your resistance to that virus without any immunization. So there was one truth, but people were fighting in this World War One trenches. But the thing was, let's make the nation healthier. And that's what was so sad is in the US, certainly, I don't know if it is any different in the UK, but in the US, that was completely discarded. It was heresy. I was lauded for daring to say that underlying health conditions were contributing to some of these deaths during COVID. But you come out the other end, and as you said, communities were split apart, sleep was disrupted, people had gained weight, they were, alcoholism was higher because, everyone was ordering stuff into their house. And so we came away really worse off and more vulnerable to the next virus than we did at the beginning of 2020.
Yeah, and it's a very good point, because we weren't going out. It was so much easier just to check that extra bottle of whiskey or vodka or gin or whatever. Might as well, because it's two for the price of whatever. All those sorts of offers that came, and people have still haven't recovered from the increased alcohol consumption since COVID times, and indeed and other comfort food and comfort eating. It's taking a long time to get back from that.
Circling around to what you're talking about with the doctors is interesting. I think it was Sir William Halstead, if I've got that, William or Edward Halstead. But anyway, when I did some kind of digging into, air quotes, the way we've always done it, the crazy residencies that these doctors had stems back to this surgeon back in, I think it was the 1800s, if I'm not mistaken, or beginning of the 1900s. And he would do these just marathon residencies, marathon surgeries. Well, years later, when they were kind of looking at it again, he was addicted to heroin and cocaine.
Yeah.
So I'm pretty sure I could stay up for 48 hours if I was loaded with those two.
With amphetamines. Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. And that's what people do. They will drive, at a less severe level, it's driving the waking day on endless cups of coffee and then thinking, oh, I've got to get some sleep. Then taking alcohol or sedatives to try and reverse that. And as we discussed last time, they're sedatives. They don't provide a biological mimic for sleep. So some of the wonderful stuff that's going on in the brain, memory formation, the creation of ideas, the clearance of toxins are actually impaired by some of these sedatives. I mean, particularly alcohol is very bad on memory formation and processing of information. And yet that cycle of stimulants and sedatives is very much the drive, I think, for many frontline staff.
Where was I going to go with that? I just was about to cycle. Oh, that's what it was. Okay, let me just write down so I can remove my dramatic pause there. all right. Well, one more thing about the business side before we transition. An interesting thing that's just really kind of popped up a lot in conversation is out of the UK, and that is a lot of corporations have tried the four-day work week, so 4 9-hour days. And it seems like it's had huge success there in Iceland and some other places. And there, from what I understand, there's a higher level of efficiency, more innovation, and then obviously, less sick time and those kind of things as well. So what are you seeing as far as that? Because as you alluded to, I think if we're going to look at the thought leaders, a lot of times the business space is really where the most, you know, cutting edge innovations are coming from.
Yeah, I think it's complicated, and I think it depends very much on the nature of the job. And one of the great things that has evaporated from the scientific community is particularly early mid-career people meeting other early mid-career scientists and forming that sort of network and those, you know, interactions and the creativity of ideas, which you can't really replicate online. And so I think that we in the university sector have been really trying to encourage people to get into the lab, get into the office. But the problem that we face in Oxford is that the commute in, this is a medieval city with very little parking, and it's expensive. I mean, you know, for young people to come from the outskirts into the city is a big deal. And you think, well, why should I spend 2 hours, you know, commuting when I would actually be more productive if I was in front of my laptop for 2 hours? So I think there's a tension. I think it's early days, and I think it needs to be looked at longitudinally, and it'll depend upon the nature of the task. I do worry, you know, we started with that loss of empathy and generosity of spirit and all the rest of it. And I wonder if our isolation from COVID times spilling into a shorter working week, there have been unintended consequences, which is we don't socialize as much, and we perhaps haven't learnt ways of compromise and the subtlety and the nuances of having a joke and laughing. And so I can see that it could be extremely useful and very helpful. But I'm slightly uneasy that there will be unintended consequences, because we are a deeply social species. You know, that's what we are. We've evolved to be part of a family and a community. And sitting in front of one of these screens day after day and not actually meeting our colleagues and friends does worry me a bit. Now, of course, I'm exaggerating. The proposal is dropping to a 4-day week, and that could well make sense. And so it means that, you know, you've got a bit of extra time. But I don't want it to go too far. And certainly in the university sector, we were saying to support staff, well, you can work 3 days out of five actually in the workplace, and now we're moving away from that, and it's much more you're expected to come in. And I think as long as there's flexibility, that makes sense. I mean, I think particularly if you've got young families, you know, or you're a carer for elderly parents or whomever, you know, having the flexibility to say, look, I've got to do that hospital appointment. I can work from home, and then carry on a bit further. That's really important. I think that flexibility is powerful. But I do worry a little bit about isolating ourselves from colleagues and a work environment.
It's interesting, the more progressive fire stations now, they've built individual rooms for the firefighters. So now you're not getting woken up if, you know, we have what we call rescues, which are basically ambulances with fire gear on them. And then you've got, you know, engines and trucks. So if the rescue has a call, the engine and the truck crew don't hear it and they stay asleep. I think it's incredible. But yeah, the problem is just exactly what you're talking about. The danger is that those crews will go to their individual rooms, you know, between calls and barely see each other. So I think there's definitely a happy medium. It makes perfect sense to protect the sleep that way. But I think now the leader in that station has to say, all right, you know, if you're going to go take a nap, that's fine. If, you know, at nighttime, that's fine. But you're going to call your family, you need a little quiet, that's fine. But the rest of the time, you need to be in these communal spaces so that we can train, work out, eat together, etc.
Well, particularly in your profession, where you're so reliant on your colleagues for your safety and the safety of the job that you're doing. So, yeah, I think that bonding is even more critical than the sorts of things that I do.
Now, you worked with my father a long time ago, and I'm going to bring up his favorite subject, which is poo. He is mad about the gut biome. It just that's if I want our conversation with my dad, I just start talking about pooticles. So, but I think it's a really important conversation because, you know, the more we learn about, you know, the brain and gut health, and the more, you know, is more evident that there's a huge connection between the two.
Yeah.
So we have, you know, certainly where I am sitting now, we have a population that sadly their nutrition is very poor. And then, you know, as we alluded to earlier, you've got sleep deprivation, you've got stress, et cetera. So, you know, what are some of the kind of breakthrough thoughts about, you know, the importance of gut health when it comes to mental health?
Yeah, I think originally when people started talking about the gut brain axis and the role of bacteria, we thought, well, how, you know, how can that work? And then, of course, depending upon the bacteria that you've got in the gut will depend upon your immune response to those bacteria. And we do know elements of the immune system can pass the blood-brain barrier and influence mood and behavior. We also know that different bacteria can be very important in the synthesis of vitamin, vitamin K, certainly vitamin B, and they can impact upon health. There's also evidence that the type of bacteria that you've got can influence your levels of dopamine and serotonin, you know, really important neurohormones in mental health. And there was a paper published just very recently, and I thought this is fabulous. And in fact, I've just been rereading it again. It was in General Psychiatry, we could send the reference to anybody who wants to read it, because what this study had shown, I think, really very interestingly, is that there were 8 different types of bacteria which were correlated with higher rates of insomnia. So the implication is that if you don't have the right gut biome, and you've got a bunch of bacteria that are of this particular group, you're going to be predisposed to insomnia. But in the same way, which is so fascinating, is that individuals with insomnia could very much influence the type of bacteria in their gut. And so there does seem to be a real correlation between sleep disturbance, insomnia, and the type of bacteria that you have and the impact that you'll have on your gut bacteria. So I think it's a very exciting time. Mechanisms still we're teasing apart, but I mean, the thing that I suppose we were uneasy about when it first surfaced is that, well, what's the evidence that these bacteria can actually interact with us? And there were some studies showing that the surface proteins of some bacteria could interact with the receptors of our gut lining and could change their biology, which I thought was absolutely fascinating. And now we know, which I think is extraordinary, a colleague of mine, Martha Marrow, in Germany, in Munich, she's got some amazing data, and I got to see this just recently, of circadian rhythms in bacteria. I mean, you know, so even these creatures that we didn't think, you know, we thought, oh yeah, sure, the photosynthetic ones, you know, the green photosynthetic bacteria, but what about the others? Well, they seem to have clocks as well, and you can see them under certain circumstances. So I think this is an immensely exciting area, and so, you know, I think there were some studies that took immunodeficient mice who had mice who'd had depleted gut bacteria, and they put bacteria from humans who either had good sleep or bad sleep from their gut into the mice, and you could replicate either good sleep or bad sleep depending upon the donor humans. So there's something going on there, really, really interesting. I mean, details are still emerging, but it's fascinating. I love it, actually. So I share that with you.
No, thank you. Well, what about the other way too? So when I we just hit, before we hit record, I was talking about the book that I wrote, and that really put me almost to a point of burnout. And I think it was just, you know, the actual workload and the stress, and then, you know, revisiting some of the things, you know, going deep as far as the stories. But that really had a massive impact on my GI system, you know, and to the point where, you know, if I'm being completely transparent, if I had to go, I had to go, you know, at certain times. So kind of flipping it around now, the gut health's impact on the brain, but what about the other way around, anxiety, stress, the impact on the gut itself?
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. And the bacteria that live in that gut. So you're going to change, you know, gut mobility and the processing of your food, you know, increased gastric acid secretion and the knock-on consequences of that. So absolutely, I mean, it's a bit trite, but it really does require a holistic approach, and you know, if you prod one thing, it's gonna wobble through the system, and so. We're now beginning to realize you can't take anything in isolation. And it's very interesting because, of course, how do we divide up our medicine into sectors? You know, so you have coronary heart disease, you have psychiatry, who don't often talk to the people in neurology. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And one of the things that we've been increasingly interested in is the whole concept of multimorbidity. Which of course, if you have one condition, let's say obesity, type 2 diabetes, you're almost certainly going to have coronary heart problems and a whole bunch of and possibly mental health issues as well. And so we should stop siloing our treatments and start to think about, you know, a much more cross-sectional a treatment to things like multimorbidity. One of the interesting things about that, you know, what's the one thing that we know that can reduce multimorbidity other than, you know, major dietary change and all the rest of it? Well, it's sleep and circadian health. It's quite fascinating. A common cross-cutting theme across multimorbidity is good sleep and circadian health, which opens up some exciting opportunities because it's an additional therapeutic option. If we can deliver, you know, good sleep, good good circadian health, we can tackle a whole raft of different conditions.
Well, this is why when I talk about the fire service, I always say we don't die of one thing, we die of everything. You know, and this, I think, is, you know, underlining, obviously, you know, the second conversation now, why this topic is so important is, you know, whatever your weakest link is going to manifest. And it's actually, this is a good segue to the next area. One thing I've seen a high prevalence on of in arguably very young firefighters is strokes. I know that's an area that you're working in now, but have you seen a correlation between sleep deprived groups and incidents of stroke?
Well, if we take the extreme situation of night shift workers, then coronary heart disease and stroke is much higher in that group. And again, it goes back to our sort of analogy of the orchestra. You know, if you think about our biology, what it's been evolved to do is deliver the right stuff at the right concentration to the right tissues and organs at the right time of day. And when you do that, you have an efficient, beautifully harmonious set of biology. But if all the bits of the body are doing things at a slightly different time, you're going to cause huge metabolic and physiological stress. And those who are vulnerable to, let's say, coronary heart disease or stroke, they will be in a much more likely to have these conditions. So yes, I mean, what we're doing in that space is using mouse models, is looking at when you have a stroke, what's the impact of time of day on the size of the stroke. And what's turning out to be fascinating is that there's a big time of day effect, and we think a circadian effect. And so why is that interesting? Because strokes happen when strokes happen. But if we know why strokes are smaller at one time of day than the other, we can then say, well, what's the environment of the brain at that time? What's causing protection at one time and taking away that protection at another time? And we think it's early days, but it's antioxidant activity seems to be quite important in protecting you from the size of the stroke you'll get. If that turns out to be true, then whenever you have a stroke, you can go in provide those the brain with those agents, let's say antioxidants, which will reduce the size of the stroke. So I think that offers, again, another good example of using circadian knowledge to improve our therapeutic interventions, in this case, in stroke. I should go back. I think I may have flippantly said, you know, a stroke whenever it happens. Well, actually, the chances of having a stroke for most people, there's about a 50% greater chance between 6 a.m. and 12 noon. So there's a German colleagues call it the Todeszone, which is the death zone, because they know very well about this. And it's due to several factors. One is that plasma stickiness, the platelets stick together. There's that early morning window when they are really quite sticky. And also, in anticipation of wake, you're increasing blood pressure to send oxygen and nutrients to a more active body. And the combination of a sharp rise in blood pressure and stronger blood viscosity can be a real a problem for ischemic stroke. And when you then take your anticoagulants or your antihypertensives, will matter enormously. And there's some evidence suggesting that in these long-acting drugs, if you take them before you go to bed, they're still at high enough concentrations to reduce that stickiness of the platelets and blunt that sharp rise in the in blood pressure. But if you take them in the morning, the time you've got up, the time you've remembered to take them, and the time they've entered the body and have their effect, you're past that Todeszone, you know, that death zone. And one study from Spain suggests that there's over, I think, about a 6-7 year period, maybe up to 10 years, that the chances of stroke were halved by taking your drugs before you went to bed, your antihypertensives, but rather than taking them first thing in the morning, which I think is really interesting. So I don't know the extent to which your young colleagues, first of all, would be aware that they might have a problem in terms of high blood pressure, because they're young and therefore they think they're immune to, they're invulnerable, and probably wouldn't even have it checked out. And if they are on drugs to improve the chances of surviving or reducing a stroke, they may be taking the drugs at perhaps an inappropriate time. It's difficult, as we said, because of course everything is misaligned. So it's a problem. But I think awareness, and certainly I think the point you made, which is even young people are vulnerable to heart attacks and stroke, should be taken into consideration, and there should be high frequency health checks in this group. And it's not difficult to do. And I don't know. I mean, what is the policy, James, about screening for high blood pressure and stroke vulnerability in that young sector?
It depends department to department. Some have pretty good, you know, physicals, and they'll do ultrasounds and a solid blood work, but a lot of them, it's the bare minimum. You know, there are recommendations by our, you know, governing bodies that, again, recommend, doesn't mean that anyone has to do it. And some of these are very, very poor. And unless you have some sort of hypertensive crisis, you may not even be on the radar. And what you were saying about, you know, waking up and then having to, you know, that spike in activity and perfusion, you think about the firefighter that's woken up at 2-3 in the morning and literally goes from zero to extreme activity. And now they're dragging hose or, you know, whatever they need to be doing. I can see how that viscosity along with that sudden spike, I mean, a huge, huge spike, would contribute to some of the cardiac events and the stroke events that we see in our profession.
Yeah, and so how? What about the concept of duty of care? Knowing that there is that potential vulnerability, why are not all young, one or all firefighters checked for these things on a routine basis? Because after all, there's a moral duty of care, but also it opens up a service to litigation. You know, I mean, there's going to be enough. Say, well, hang on, you know, why did you not? You know, I am. My occupation means that I'm much more vulnerable to that sort of incident. Why aren't you screening me for my vulnerability to that? So I can imagine that the employers might be resistant, but also some employees might be resistant because they don't want to lose their job. I mean, how does that work out?
What we've really seen is there's a complete resistance to the proactive approach. So, for example, there will be like a heart and lung bill. So if, you know, I get cancer, then, you know, you can show that it's related to the profession, then you might get a $50,000 payout to your family when you die. I don't think that's a very, you know, positive way of doing it. So what we need to do as a profession is shift to the proactive approach. And one of the big things that you and I spoke about last time is this resistance to the very concept that the work week that we have at the moment is killing our people. And then since we spoke, the recruitment crisis just got worse. So as less and less people wanted to join the profession, the ones that are left are working even longer now. So a 56-hour week, you know, you get a phone call at 7:30 in the morning, gearing, you can't go home. And now it's an 80-hour work week that week, you know, of you know, like disrupted or no sleep 4 days of that week. So until they acknowledge the elephants in the room, the herd of them, you know, with that, then, you know, I feel like that the other conversations are falling on even deafer ears. But there is a revolution happening in Florida where the last 2 years, so since we spoke, I think we're up to 9 fire departments now have made this shift. And lo and behold, when they fix that, now this conversation of putting in fitness standards and annual screenings. And so when you address that massive roadblock that is just, you know, in my opinion, really being used as a tool of cowardice, because if I just deny it, then I don't have to deal with it, you know, as a leader. So now that they are starting to deal with it, it's opening the door to all these other areas that they can improve simultaneously. So it's exciting to see these real leaders in the fire service kind of pushing that forward.
That's really good. And of course, you know, we touched last time on the educational piece about people also need to take some responsibility and to be sensitive to what may be happening to them. But not just them, but the people they spend their lives with. So their partners and the families also need to know about some of the problems. And I think we touched on last time, in some sectors, the divorce rate can be 6 times higher in the night shift work compared to the day shift. Now, I don't know what the statistics are like in your area, but suspect.
Awful.
Yeah. And of course, I think they're awful. I remember when we were talking about this sort of thing, again, going back to the mining area in northwestern Australia, and we were saying these are all the things, and, you know, the impulsivity, the lack of empathy and all the rest of it. And this woman in the audience started crying. And she said, I've been so mean to my husband and, you know, accusing him of all these things. And I had no idea that this was the consequence of the job he's doing, which is trying to put food on the table for us. And I think there's a very important educational piece for partners and families. It's a problem that is not just on the individual, but it's the broader community in which they spend their time.
Well, I mean, twofold. Firstly, when we are at the station, our partners are single parents for 24 hours. If they're wildland firefighters, it might be, you know, a week, couple of weeks. And so you have this kind of shift of dynamic that way, because we come home exhausted, but they've been, you know, taking care of the children and their own profession. And so, you know, you've got that kind of jarring interaction when we come back.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of the people said, you know, when my partner comes back, I say, right, I've done my bit. Here's the child. You take over. And of course, they're exhausted. They can't do it. But it was that, it's that failure to appreciate the demands of the job. Again, there's an educational piece here that we must address.
Well, even the ownership. I think this circles around to, you know, my question about critical thinking and fatigue is I have literally had people say, we don't want the 24/72, the 42-hour work week. We want the 48/96, the 56-hour work week. Now, any, you know, person who's well-rested is going to look at that and go, that's ridiculous. The partners of these people are going to say, that's ridiculous. You don't want to come home an extra day between your shifts. But this is where I think, you know, with the ownership piece, we struggle so much. I mean, we touched on it last time, as far as the impact of sleep deprivation on obesity and testosterone and all these other areas too. But when you have an underslept, overstressed population, getting them to advocate for themselves is so hard because they cannot critically think.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Well, I want to hit one more area because I know we're getting close to time. Last time you and I spoke, you told some incredible stories about, you know, some of the blind veterans, and then you talked about developing a drug that can initiate the chronobiology when someone doesn't have the capacity to with the eye. So talk to me about where you are now, and then, you know, what are some of the hurdles that you're trying to overcome at the moment?
Yeah, so it's been both exciting and disappointing. So on the basis of the preclinical work that we've done, the FDA said this is a priority area and you've got orphan drug status, which is this is very exciting, and this could be used for non-24-hour individuals who cannot lock their internal clock onto the external light-dark cycle. And we then went on and with our colleagues in Australia showed that the drug is safe. But we've now fallen into that classic sort of valley of death that you find for so many startups, which is we're too tiny for big pharma, because we're asking for about $7 million, something like that. And they said, well, no, that's just not, you know, that's the kind of stuff you find down the back of your sofa. This is we're interested in the 50, 100, 300 million type stuff. But $7 million is too big for small investors. So we're still in that valley. One very exciting piece of news, though, is that the Michael J. Fox Foundation, who are aware that sleep disruption is a big issue in Parkinson's, have asked us to see whether this drug might be useful in, again, these are preclinical, these are mouse studies where there are mouse models of Parkinson. Will it improve their rest activity and their sleep wake? So we are shuffling forward, but you know, it's so easy to do the human trial, which is basically you keep people under dim constant light. You give an injection of the drug, same time every day. Do their rhythms lock on or don't they? If they lock on, just like mice, and I have every anticipation that they will, then we've actually given back a sense of time to the time blind. And as I think we said last time, I mean, many people have lost their eyes. You know, say to me, look, I can cope with the blindness. It's awful. But I can find ways around it. What I can't cope with is my body constantly fooling me about what time of day it is and what I should be doing when. And so when I should feel hungry with my family, when I should try and work, you know. And I think that's what I want to do for the last part of my career, is give back a sense of time to the time blind. And as we probably also said, it's not just the profoundly blind, but you know, our work on schizophrenia and other mental health conditions, and in neurodevelopmental conditions, and in neurodiversity, where sleep-wake timing is a major issue for the individual and the family or the people they spend their lives with. So I think there's enormous potential. And some further work has also looked at another drug, which very exciting because it increases the amplitude of the circadian oscillation. As we age, for example, that begins to flatten out, which means that you don't have the same precision, which is why sleep is less robust as we age. Why, for example, urine production, you know, the hormones underpinning urine production, you know, produce urine during the day, not at night, starts to flatten out. And therefore you're going to be more disturbed by wanting to get up and pee at night. Some of metabolic conditions, there's also strong evidence there's a flattening out of metabolic dynamics. And so, for example, we were looking on mice fed on a high fat diet with fatty liver disease and under a normal diet. When you gave this drug, and all it was doing was increase the amplitude of the circadian oscillation, you reduce the fatty liver by a huge amount. So again, I think there are exciting things sort of in the pipeline. But the problem is we still are sort of regarded as a bit kind of peripheral. Circadian rhythms and sleep are not thought about as being central and one of the pillars of health. which is why, and we were chatting about this before we started recording, there's going to be an initiative in Oxford for a Center for Circadian Health. We've got the Sleep and Circadian Neuroscience Institute, which is fundamental neuroscience and underpinning. Now we want to embed this knowledge across the health spectrum. We've talked about stroke, cardiovascular disease. I mean, there's metabolism, there's mental health, and we've got to get practitioners in these areas utilizing this knowledge, and also fundamental scientists working with our clinical colleagues, developing new knowledge to solve some of these problems. So yeah, we shuffle forward, but I remain optimistic. And particularly, I think with this new initiative, if we can get a Center for Circadian Health off the ground, and it will be based in Oxford, but we'll obviously have close connections with our colleagues in Australia, in Japan, and in Germany, where we already have active collaborations. I think we can probably do something exciting, change some ideas, change some attitudes, and of course, Absolutely. Shift work will be a key area.
Yeah, no. I mean, this is, I guess, illustrating the fact that it's not just my profession, that even in your world, in the health world in general, that there's still this kind of poo-pooing of the importance of sleep. And I think this resistance I'm seeing, sadly, is because sleep is free. You know, it's going to be hard to keep selling some of these drugs when you realize that, as you mentioned earlier, this holistic approach, the exercise, the sleep, you know, the nutrition, truly is the answer to so many areas. But I know that we've talked about this. I think we hit it last time, you know, even the sleep disruption amplifying issues of autism and some of these other issues. Oh, yeah. You know, if we can just get people back sleeping again, from obesity to, you know, neurodiversity, what massive impact would that have?
Well, I think neurodiversity is a very interesting area, because since last we talked, there is much greater interest in that whole area. And it's trying to understand, well, why is sleep so difficult in neurodivergent, you know, kids in particular? And it's trying to understand, well, it's a lack of understanding in some neurodivergent individuals of picking up the signals for transitioning from what now should be awake and now should be asleep. What are the signs? What are the things that they need to log on to know that this is what's going? And therefore, structure becomes so very important in those kids. You know, now, and explain, this is what we're doing. You now put your night clothes on, because it's just making it very, very structured. The other problem, of course, is that the sensory thresholds for some neurodivergent children are very different. So they're going to be much more alert and much more awake because of what's going on in their environment. And so again, minimizing noise, minimizing light, and keeping stability. Practically, that's often very tricky in a normal domestic setting. But these are the things that people are now beginning to take seriously in trying to get the sleep for these individuals.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't the drug that they usually prescribe amphetamine as well, which I'm assuming would dysregulate sleep? Yeah.
Well, absolutely, yes. I mean, I think this is the problem, because we've got so very few tools that will regulate sleep and circadian rhythms. We've got drugs that will sedate you, but that isn't the issue. We need to regulate those different systems, not sedate the individual. And that's the, I think, the exciting future. And I suspect, you know, when I'm long retired, it's going to be, you know, a conversation 20 years from now that, oh, yeah, it's extraordinary. You know, these have come on the market and we've just now transformed this space. And I don't want to imply that a drug is the magic answer. I'm talking about where we can't use cognitive behavioral therapy and behavioral change, where behavioral change isn't going to work, as in the blind, for example, then drugs could be useful. And I wouldn't propose that, you know, you use a drug to mimic the effects of light on the clock and keep somebody on it. You get the situation stable, and then you move to sort of behavioral change and the regular exposure to light and things like that. So there's one trend that's alarming me in the States, which is the use of melatonin gummies for kids. And first of all, the evidence that melatonin it's not, as we discussed last time, it's not a sleep hormone. It's a mild regulator. But I do feel uneasy that parents are just giving a gummy rather than using behavioral approaches to allow the child to understand what they need to do to transition into sleep. Because, you know, even young kids know what's going on. And again, we go back to autism, but, you know, a structure. Now this is what you're doing and you're winding down. And certainly from my time in the States, I saw some parents who would put their kids in front of the telly, and it was these really violent cartoons and very, very lots of images, lots of bright and all the rest of it, and then expect them to go to sleep after that. It's where we've come full circle. Where have we stopped reading a gentle bedtime story to a child at the end of the day, and have that bonding and that relaxation and the realization that now it's sleep time? And we've lost the childhood story, I think, in so many families. And of course you can understand it, because so many families are utterly pressure driven and exhausted at the end of the day. It's usually the mother or the father that falls asleep before the child, if they do a bedtime story. Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny. Actually, I used to read my son, Dr. Seuss, that, the places you'll go. And he just turned 18 a couple of days ago. And I put a little, you know, social media collage, but there was, that I found a song that had those words. And it's, you know, if I just stuck a tablet in front of him, I would have lost that quality time with him, that bonding, you know, and that's a chance for the child to kind of talk about their day and get anything off their mind before they then go to sleep. So I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think even if, you know, you are a very electronic based family, still carve out, you know, 10 minutes before the child goes to bed and just pick up a book.
My mother used to sing a song to me, which is, "Oh, little man, you've had a busy day." And I can still remember vaguely her singing this to me. And I actually went online and I got the score to it, and I read the words, and it all came flooding back, because that's how we used to end the day. You know, "Oh, little man, you've had a busy day." It's wonderful.
Absolutely. Well, for people listening, your book is Lifetime. I mean, so many things that we spoke about last time and this time are in here, understanding, you know, sleep biology in the first place, and then shift work and the chronic effects and the acute effects and, you know, solutions, you know, sleep hygiene, so much in there. So for people listening, where are the best places to find the book? And then when are you anticipating the second one coming out?
Well, so Lifetime, it should be available in all good bookstores. You can order it, of course, through online retailers like Amazon. It's done well. You know, it was a bestseller in the UK, both in paperback and hardback, which was really exciting. The next book is on, we're still deciding on the title, but it's all about light. And a big chunk of it will be the impact of light on human health, going through, I mean, I'm fascinated. You know, and really the whole nature of the book started because, you know, you sit around with a bunch of friends and you say, okay, well, tell me how light is generated in the sun. And yeah, this is a reasonably well-educated group of people. Nobody could explain it. So I thought, God, this is fundamental, you know. And so the book deals with vision, obviously, and how we detect light and process light, and to some extent why we're different from other animals. So there'll be a comparative, you know, OOR stuff. Then we'll have vitamin D synthesis, which is again so interesting. You know, we always think vitamin D is made in the skin. No, the precursor is made in the skin because of UVB light, but then it has to go to the liver and then the kidney to produce the active form of vitamin D. Which means if you have liver disease or kidney disease, you're going to be vitamin D deprived. And what's the latest science on the use of the role of vitamin D? And then, of course, skin cancer. Then color psychology, which is, I think, really incredible. So the power of red. And so that will be photosynthesis. Why the production of oxygen by green plants essentially has allowed complex life to exist on the planet. And of course, if it weren't for ozone, then which is a form of oxygen, we would be bombarded with high energy photons from the sun, and you know, we'd be killed. We'd get, you know, mutations, and all the way through to light and architecture. So I wanted to try and bring all these topics with a central theme of human health together. It'll be out, assuming I can. I think the plans are to try and get it out at the beginning of 2027, so in about a year and a half's time. So if I can peel my finger out and get the revisions done.
Well, just super quickly, I know you got to go with skin cancer. You know, I kind of try and revert my thinking back to what have we done most of the time as far as, you know, human history. And there's this culture now where if you step out the sun for 5 minutes and you're going to get sunburnt, you're going to get skin cancer. So slather yourself in these chemicals before you walk out the door. What are you seeing very briefly between the connection of, you know, sensible, you know, skin exposure, because obviously your skin will tell you when it's had too much, and skin cancer specifically?
It's tricky. And of course, this is what the Australians face, is a huge dilemma, because they have this slip, slap, slop, which is, you know, it's all about going out and covering up and putting skin. And that makes a lot of sense with that high levels of sun. You don't need to be out for long to get the vitamin D that you need. So it does pay to take obviously protection. And the number of skin cancers has gone up even in places like the UK. That has, of course, been associated with increased use of sunbeds, which are largely unregulated. Certainly a survey by the European Commission fairly recently showed that most of the sun, or a big chunk of the sunbeds that were being used, were actually producing dangerous levels of ultraviolet light. So, you know, you should never use a sunbed. And if you get out there, be careful. And there's also been a move saying, oh, there's too many skin checks for melanoma and all the rest of it. And I chatted, and it was sort of, there's a group of individuals proposing this. I spoke to the skincare people in Australia and elsewhere. They said, no. Don't ever think about not having regular skin checks, because it will save your life. The other area, though, that is incredibly interesting is the development of myopia and short-sightedness. So in some Southeast Asian countries, in urban young, the level of myopia is greater than 95%. So these kids are having to wear corrective spectacles to get rid of the short-sightedness. And there's now very interesting data showing that time outside is strongly correlated with the reduction in the chance of developing myopia. And we were saying earlier, right at the beginning, you know, we live in dim, dark caves, and that's the problem. You know, we're spending all of our time inside under low levels of light, and it seems that that is a serious issue and a serious risk factor for the development of myopia. So anyway, the book is trying to pull all these this extraordinary giver of life, sunlight, I mean, that's made us what we are, and also, you know, allows us to sample our world through vision, and change our view of the world depending on what color we see. I mean, there's a whole area of commercial, the color psychology of why you buy certain objects because of the color, and so I go through the entire gambit, and I hadn't realized how difficult the book would be to write. Of course, and there's lots of stuff on circadian rhythms and seasonal rhythms, actually. Yeah.
It's interesting you say about the myopia. My wife just became a doctor of optometry here. And that's what I've said to her is, you know, from thinking from an evolutionary point of view, why is it that so many of us need glasses so often? Because from a survival point of view, you'd think that wouldn't be the case. I was saying to her, I guarantee you a lot of these modern things that we have now are making this worse. And what you've just said makes perfect sense. You know, if we're not having that distance focus, over and over again, and the exposure to light, and we're looking at these devices, you know, a few inches from our face, of course, it's going to, even just from a muscular point of view, optically, it's going to change the way that, you know, the spectrum of use of that particular organ.
Yeah, it's the precise mechanisms are not absolutely clear, but it looks like the role of light releasing dopamine within the eye, which is changing the architecture and the shape of the eye. So stop it elongating, which is causing myopia, and get it to sort of correct. The precise mechanisms remain unknown, which I think is extraordinary. When you think of the percentage of individuals that will need corrective sort of spectacles around the world because of myopia is in the billions. And the cost of that to the individual and the state will be huge. Yet we don't understand the mechanisms. Amazing.
It really is. All right. Well, for people listening, if they want to learn more about your work, reach out to you, where are the best places online?
Yeah, the website, the of course, most websites, they're a little bit out of date, but there's websites. But if you do a Google, then there's sort of various talks and things I've done that will be online and available. And of course, if you really need a question answered, then drop me an email.
Brilliant. Well, I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time. I know you've got to go now, but it's been another fascinating conversation. So thank you for coming back onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
James, always my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me. And we'll hopefully catch up again soon.